the director of Common Ground. We are a mediation program that's been serving Greene and Columbia County since 1987. And I really hope that you find this program to be helpful and informative, and that you enjoy the evening. And I hope you help yourself and continue to help yourself to the wonderful food that is back there. Before I begin, I just really want to thank my staff, George Kleinmeier, who's back there, and Jessica Lackey, who could not be here this evening. And I also want to thank George's wife, Gloria, who made the wonderful ziti. I know. I'd like to introduce our panel. This is Frances Oley. Florence is the director of Community Action. And Doug Coleman is an attorney practicing in this area. Frank Cuthbert is a landlord and a realtor in Catskill. He has been managing his own property for 20 years. And David Lewis is a volunteer mediator for Common Ground. He's the former town supervisor of the town of New Baltimore. He also is a professional mediator, and he does a lot of volunteer work. He works, as I said, for Common Ground as a volunteer, and he also works for another mediation center in Albany, Mediation Matters. He has managed a variety of conflicts ranging from families to landlords and tenants, neighborhood disputes, and David also is got a private mediation practice. Larry Krajewski is the head of Catskill Mountain Housing. And those of you who may not be familiar with Catskill Mountain Housing, it's a not-for-profit agency whose purpose is to purchase or rehabilitate structures in order to make available affordable housing to the elderly and those of low and moderate income through management, renting, leasing, or for sale. And Maria Markovic. Maria is the head of the United Tenants of Albany. The United Tenants is a community-based, not-for-profit organization that works to improve housing conditions, both in terms of physical condition and in terms of tenants' rights for security and equity. In your program, you will notice that each presenter has a special area of expertise, and each person will be speaking within that category. But before we begin, I just want to bring your attention to this paper here. And I'd ask that each of you respect these ground rules, that if you have questions, to hold your questions until everyone has had a chance to present, and that you not interrupt the presenters while they're talking or while anyone else is talking, and that you just respect the rules of common courtesy. And the other thing is, if you have a cell phone, if you could just put it on vibrate, and if you have to take the call, obviously take the call. Thanks. And Maria.
Okay. I'm going to pass out literature as we go along. I don't know, have any of you ever called United Tenants of Albany? Okay, United Tenants is 37 years old, and we have a variety of services. We run a housing hotline, which honestly is very hard to get through on. The phone is very, very busy. And we also have people coming into the office with their problems. We run a homeless prevention services where we have somebody who goes to court to advocate in court, helps mediate. We have emergency assistance available to help people keep their apartments, those kinds of programs. So, you know, our goal is to make sure that people know about their rights and to, you know, be able to maintain their housing. I'm going to give you last year's report. It tells a little bit about the services. See, this is what happens when you spread out. Everything rests on this guy who passes it out. So just turn it around. First thing I'm going to talk about is when you look for an apartment. These two women in the back said to me, you know all about this. You've had some doozy of landlords, you said. So, you know, when you go to look for an apartment, you know, there are some very basic questions you should ask. Let me ask you, what do you think some of the things you would look out for when you're looking for an apartment?
Cleanliness.
All right, so cleanliness, what else?
Location.
Location, and location. What about, you know, with the rent? What, do you ask what's included or not?
Yes.
I mean, sometimes people don't ask those questions, and they're surprised when they get a water bill, because they assume, you know, the landlord should be paying the water bill. Do you ask what kind of heat it is?
Yeah.
Is it gas or electric? Electric heat can be very expensive, right? Do you ask, like, if the heat's included or not, where the thermostat is, who controls the heat? If you see some wires hanging down, what do you do? Keep looking, right? Don't stop. And these are some basic things when you look for an apartment. One of the biggest problems I think people run into is when they find an apartment, they think they want it, but then they put down a deposit to hold the apartment, and then they change their mind. We get quite a few calls about that. So be very careful if you put a deposit down to hold an apartment that you really want it, because it can, if you wait a week and say to the landlord, I really don't think I want this apartment, he may be able to hold on to that. So, you know, be very careful to make sure you really do want the apartment when you put money down to hold it. That's a big issue. When you give your security deposit, the other thing is to make note if there's any problems, you know, there's a hole in the wall, the owner says he's going to fix, make sure that you note that down so that later you don't get charged when you want to get your security deposit back, right? Security deposits, get a lot of calls about security deposits. You know, security deposits should go in separate accounts. If there's six or more apartments in the building, they have to go in an interest-bearing account, which nowadays the interest is minimal, but it's what the bank pays less 1%. And, you know, even if there's less than six, most likely it is going to go into some kind of account that's interest-bearing, so you're entitled to that. How many of you have... who are renting? How many of you are renting? Raise your hands. Just one? You guys renting?
No.
No?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have a lease or are you month to month?
Month.
You're month to month? You have a lease. Okay. When you go to rent around here, do most landlords offer leases or not? Yes? Okay. Let me just start by month to month. Month to month means that you have really, you know, you don't have any written contract, right? So your tenancy basically goes from month to month, like it says. What do you think the advantages are of that? You want to move, what do you have? You can give a month's notice, right? Disadvantages. Right. The landlord can tell you to move, but he has to give you a month's notice. When you're on a month, and the landlord can give you a month's notice and raise your rent. Now, when you're on a month to month, let's say you pay your rent on the first of the month. If you want to move and you give a month's notice to move, let's say you want to move January 1st. Want to leave December 31st, you should tell the landlord by November 30th that you want to move, right? So if you pay your rent on the 1st, you need to give a full month's notice. So if you can't just decide November 5th, you're going to tell them you want to move December 5th or November 15th, December 15th. If you don't give proper notice, He has to give you a full... FEMA dollars, ESG dollars. So if you really want to stay there, make sure, one, you got to go to court. If you don't go to court, the landlord can get a final order of eviction. So it's important to go if you feel that you want to be able to stay there. Sometimes people hold back on the rent because they have code violations. I'm sure there's a code bureau down here that, when you have violations, you can call the code bureau, they do an inspection. We always encourage, before people withhold rent, we always tell them to get copies of the inspection report. And, it's important to bring that to court with you. And if you are withholding rent, that means you're having the rent money when you go to court. The other issue we get quite a few calls about is court is that they only serve the petition in the same county that you file it. So if your landlord lives in New York City, and you're in Greene County, that's a real problem. What do you do then? We haven't figured it out yet. If you can find somebody who's acting as agent, at least in the Albany City courts, they'll allow that to, you know, person to be sued. You know, the other avenue is to file a complaint with the Attorney General's office. Basically, complaints there, though, on this scale, are just received and you send a notice to the owner. The Attorney General's office is not going to go after your $582, unfortunately. So that is a problem. One other area that we've been experiencing more and more in Albany, and I'm assuming maybe it's happening in Greene County, is that we're, with the whole foreclosure crisis, we're seeing more and more tenants who are renting from landlords whose buildings are in foreclosure. When the bank took over the building, you know, they could get very quickly put out. New federal law and state law says that now, when a lender takes over the mortgage, the tenant has 90 days to relocate. If you have a lease, the lender has to honor the terms of that lease, including like if it's sectioned. So things are a lot better. But our experience, probably over the past year, we've had calls where people file complaints from about 90 to 100 families have been in foreclosure. And a lot of times what happens is the tenants will also get copies of those. If you have
out the rights and responsibilities of both parties. This year, it outlines what the rent is going to be, And it gets very specific about the duties and obligations of both parties. So that if you are a tenant entering into a lease with a landlord, you should understand clearly that this is a legal document and read it carefully before you sign it. If you have any questions about it, before you sign it is the time to ask the questions. And if you have any objections or concerns about any aspect of the lease, understanding of what the lease says, and if you have any other ideas or issues that you want to address, in any relationship, there are things that both parties want. Tenants want to feel comfortable in the space where they'll be living. They want to feel comfortable with the neighborhood, probably with the other tenants in the building if it's an apartment building. And they want to feel comfortable with the landlord and feel sure that the landlord that they're entering into this relationship with is going to be conscientious and responsible, that the landlord is going to maintain the property and fix things that get broken, going to provide heat if heat is provided in the rental or lease agreement, and provide whatever other services might be outlined in a lease. Before you leave, as the previous speaker mentioned, if there are things that don't work, they should be noted and brought up on the front end so that the landlord has an opportunity to repair them. And certainly at the tail end, when you leave the apartment, that the landlord can't come to you and say, gee, this is broken and these should be things, much like buying a car, or if you've ever rented a car, before I rent a car, I look around the car to make sure there's no dings and scratches and so forth, because when I bring the car back, I don't want the rental agent to say to me, this car was perfect when you got it, and now it's got a ding. Space and the responsibility level of the landlord. Landlords also need to feel comfortable. I need to feel comfortable with the people that are going to be occupying my premises. Almost all of the buildings I've personally worked on. I've painted and sheetrocked and had a crew and fixed up. And so I have an investment, not only a financial investment, but an emotional investment in a space. And I certainly want to be sure that the people that are in the space have the same level of respect for the space that I would have for someone else's space. Will the rent be paid on time? Will the tenants respect the space? Will the tenants respect your neighbors? While there are ordinances in most towns that dictate that at a certain time, maybe 10 or 11 o'clock at night, noise levels must be reduced to a certain level, a lot of the conflicts that I've had over the years among tenants have been related to just people's lack of respect for their neighbors. Whatever type of music you like to listen to, you have to be aware that maybe all the other neighbors aren't necessarily, even if they like the music, that's what at a level that was just unacceptable. Domestic disputes, arguing, and just issues of loudness pertain to respect, particularly when you're living in close quarters in an apartment building where there may be four or six or ten apartments. I'm also interested in, obviously, tenants' desire to keep up their own space. When I've rented space in the past for myself, I had a certain pride that this was my home, that I could own it, and tried to keep it clean. So the idea of respecting space, respecting their neighbors, and keeping the place clean and tidy is of importance to me. I've met many dozens or hundreds of tenants over the years, and when you meet somebody for the first time in that relationship, the landlord-tenant relationship is sort of like dating. You know, for the first date, everybody puts on a good face. You've got one chance to make a good impression. And so most tenants that I meet try very hard to impress me, to say the right thing, to look good, to look sharp. And I appreciate that, but experience has taught me that I need to ask some very directed questions to find out if this individual or these individuals are going to be good tenants for me. So I'd like to shift now to really the title or the theme that Dawn asked me to talk about, which is the qualities of a good tenant. And this is from my perspective. Please think about these points that I'm going to raise as they relate to you and how you could think honestly about where you stand with all these points, and if there are some shortcomings, how you might address them in preparation of meeting with a landlord and hopefully consummating a deal where you're able to rent the apartment or house that you're interested in. The first quality of a good tenant for me is income to pay the rent and the security. Like a bank that's issuing a mortgage, banks have specific guidelines for how much money they're going to give you. And usually they base it on two percentages. One percentage is a gross percentage of your monthly income. In other words, if you make $2,000 a month, with you having a mortgage of roughly one-third of that, so about $700 a month, the bank would feel you could cover that mortgage if you made $2,000 a month. There's another ratio, which is a net income ratio, which is about 25% of what you make a month. So if you make $2,000, the bank would say that you can afford to spend $500 a month for rent after we consider all of your items, credit card debts, you might have a car loan, you might have a student loan, you might have alimony, you might have child support. So someone might say, $700, I make $2,000 a month. And I go, gee, that's great. But my personal inspection, I find that they also have a brand new SUV that they're paying $300 a month, alimony of two, and child support of $200 a week. $2,000. They don't have the amount of money that on first blush they're presenting to me. In reality, they've got $1,000 a month after you consider all their expenses. So if they want to rent my $700 a month apartment, I say, gee, if you've got $1,000 a month, how are we going to eat? Well, I just think that's a little too tight. I just don't think it's going to work. And so the first thing that I look at with regard to a tenant is, can they pay the rent? Most landlords require the first month's rent and a month's security. That's what I require. Many landlords require first, last, and a month's security. I don't. But if a tenant comes to me and is interested in an apartment and doesn't have the ability to come up with the first month's rent, that's a little bit of a red flag. I won't say that I've never rented an apartment to somebody who's unable to come up with the security. I've done that dozens of times because I take it on a case-by-case basis. It's not a hard and fast rule. But it is a little bit of an alert sign going up for me that, gee, they don't have the security. They've got the first month's rent. Maybe they've got half the month's security, and we'll work something out until it's all paid up. I've done that many times. But just be aware that from a landlord standpoint, it makes somebody wonder, is this person going to be able to afford the rent? So the first quality of a good tenant is the ability to pay the rent. The second quality of a good tenant is credit worthiness. And by that I mean payment history. References from a previous landlord are so important to me that even if somebody was a little bit questionable, I got some references from a previous landlord that showed stability, that showed this person was a good tenant, it would mean a lot to me. As life goes on, somebody told me when I was, I think in my early 30s, I was in a, all of my 20s I was a musician. I was in a band and I was, didn't have credit cards and didn't have references and lived a completely different life. And somebody, one of my good friends then said to me, Gino, you really need to begin building a home credit. So I applied for a credit card and began to realize how important these stepping stones are in life when you're in your 20s and you're in your 30s and even in your 40s. The opportunity to build a good relationship with a landlord and then take that on with you, it's a very significant and powerful tool. I've had a lot of people that have been tenants of mine for 1, 2, or 3, or 4 years who fulfilled the obligations of the lease, who were good tenants, who paid on time, or pretty much on time. And at the end of 2 or 3 years, they came to me and said, gee, you know, I'm leaving Greene County, I'm moving to Florida, or moving to North Carolina, and I'm going to be looking for a spot down there. Would you give me a letter of reference? What a good relationship you had, because when you go to the next landlord, somebody like me, having that to present to me is very, very valuable. It really makes me feel comfortable. In any relationship, it's all about and so however many ways people can make me feel comfortable, it builds their case for why they should be in that apartment. To give you, this is a little bit of a sidebar, but to give you an idea about comfortability, and I talk about this in the next point about stability, legacy of stability that you might bring to the table. But there have been a lot of people that have come to me for apartments who are new to the area, who don't know anybody in the area, who just bought an apartment, no work track. In the spirit of comfortability, I've said to a number of people, you really want the apartment. If you can give me 6 months' rent up front, you've made me feel comfortable. Even though maybe you don't even have a job, but you've got some money. You're going to find a job. You're an ambitious person. And I've done that a number of times as well, because that 6 months' rent up front made me feel comfortable. And during that period of 6 months, that person found a job. And at the end of 6 months, they just paid on a month-to-month basis. But succeeded in making me pay attention. One other point, after income to pay, after credit worthiness, I should say also regarding credit worthiness, many landlords check available public records and see if somebody's been evicted. That's one of the questions that I have on my application, have you ever been evicted? They also can look and see if there are any judgments against someone. And this talks to the issue of credit worthiness. If you ever have been evicted and you feel that there might be some reasons why you could state your case. I lost my job. I just couldn't pay the rent anymore, and the landlord had to evict me. But I wouldn't lie. I would always come up front with whatever your history is. Be very truthful about it, because all this information is readily available. And any landlord that's good at business and checking up on people, following up on the applications, is going to find that out. The worst thing for a tenant to do, and this has happened a number of times, is to lie on an application. Because once that happens, it's just, you know, it's over. So be honest, and if you have good reasons for why a judgment shows up or why an eviction shows up, I'd be real forthright. And in your preparation for meeting a landlord, you should consider all of these things before you even fill out an application. The other issue, or the quality of a good tenant to me, is stability. I've had tenants come to me and fill out an application. I say, where did you live last? In this spot. How long were you there? 3 months. Why did you leave? I didn't like the landlord. Okay. Where did you live before that? I lived such and such a place. How long were you there? 6 months. Why did you leave? The neighbors and I couldn't get along. The neighbors were too loud. Okay. Where'd you live before that? And when I see a record of, that doesn't produce a feeling of stability, that somebody really wants to take roots, where there are no long-term relationships, whether in their residence or in their job. Where do you work? Dunkin' Donuts. How long have you been there? 2 weeks. Where'd you work before that? Joe's Tire. How long were you there? 4 months. What happened there? Need to feel comfortable. So if you're somebody who moves around a lot, that doesn't make me feel comfortable. And if you're somebody that bounces from job to job, that doesn't make a landlord feel comfortable. So in preparation, if you're meeting with the landlord, consider these things in your history. Many people have come to me who have just gotten a job, and I said, well, listen, you seem like a good person after you've been on the job for a while, and I'm secure that you have a job, come back to me in 6 months. And then we can talk. I might have something for you. But I don't know if you're going to last a week in this job. So landlords desire a long-term relationship with tenants. And the main reason is because it's very costly when a tenant moves out. When somebody moves out of an apartment, I've got to clean the apartment. I probably have to repaint the apartment. I have to run another ad, and the likelihood is it's going to take a month or two before I get another tenant in there. So if the rent was $700 a month, I've lost $1,400 in rent, in addition to probably the $700 that it's going to cost me to clean up the apartment, fix up the little scuffs on the wall, take out whatever garbage that the previous tenant didn't work, take that to the dump. So it's a $2,000 loss for a landlord. And so for somebody like me, I'd rather be comfortable on the front end and know that whoever is moving in is likely to stay there for a little while. That's very attractive to me. The last quality of a good tenant relates to the suitability of the space that I have for rent and the tenant and or the tenant's family. I've had a number of people looking at apartments in a two-bedroom apartment for themselves, the husband, wife, and their seven children. And situations like that don't work. I like to put a tenant in a space that's going to work for their family. So if you are going for an apartment, most landlords don't buy the idea that the children can sleep on the couch or you'll get three bunk beds in a room. There are also, I believe, somebody may know more about this than I, but I believe HUD also has some qualifications regarding children of an opposite sex beyond a certain age. So you might have a two-bedroom, but if the parents have two kids, a boy and a girl, that are maybe entering their teens or something like that, they're not supposed to be sharing the same bedroom. And I think there are guidelines that reflect that. So does the apartment needs is an important question to ask. Just by way of summary, qualities of a good tenant: the ability to pay the rent, creditworthiness, a record of stability, and suitability of family size for the space that might be for rent. And rule number one for any tenant-landlord relationship is communication up front and during the course of the tenancy. Be open, be honest, and communicate with the landlord. And I think the landlord will respect that, and you'll get the most out of the relationship. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Doug is going to talk about the eviction process. Thank you.
In preparing my remarks, I didn't know how much detail to go into. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail because you probably would need an attorney to actually utilize it. But during the Q&A, if you have questions, I'll try to answer them. Most evictions are going to be for non-payment, but there's others. There's pretty much everything that isn't non-payment falls under what's called a holdover. But it doesn't, even though it's called holdover, it doesn't necessarily just mean it's for tenants who are staying past the end of their lease period. I will say, you know, most tenants are not going to have an attorney, and in fact, many landlords don't have an attorney. And judges realize that they're dealing with lay people, and in fact, you know, a lot of judges are lay people in the town courts. And even though evictions are statutory and they're supposed to strictly be followed, the judges try to balance the interest between the landlord's desire to have the rent paid and get their you know, apartment back so they can rent it to somebody who is going to pay it, and the tenant who may need, you know, may have fallen into a difficult situation and needs a little bit of additional time to find a new place to live. And I think Maria had mentioned that, you know, the judges will try to get people to work together and see, maybe the landlord will give you a little bit more time to find another place, or can kind of drag it out, you know, the judge can drag out the proceeding a little bit, even if the landlord doesn't want to. Let's see. The basic procedure is, whether it's a holdover or a non-payment, there's what they call predicate notices that have to be given. And for a non-payment, you either have to make a demand, the landlord either has to make a demand for the rent or has to give a 3-day notice in writing, okay? And if they don't do that, then there's no authority for the court to hear the eviction proceeding. It has to be dismissed. Now, a lot of judges don't know that, so if nobody raises it to the judge is going to continue with the proceeding. Now, that's a big deal, and it could buy you a lot of time because then the landlord has to start from scratch. So, you know, there's no right to continue to live in the apartment and not pay rent. So the best you can usually, you know, do is slow down the process. But if they've taken the time to prepare their petition and file it and then serve you, you know, you could gain another 2, 3, 4 weeks in some cases. So that's important that the proper notices are served, because those are what's called jurisdictional, and the court has no authority to hear the case if those notices aren't given. Not only does the notice have to be given, it also has to be stated in the petition that the notice was given. So that's also jurisdictional, meaning if the landlord gave the notice but didn't put it in the petition has to be dismissed, so that would gain you a significant amount of time as well. After they give the notice, then the landlord can file a petition. And the petition just states that there is a landlord-tenant relationship, and that the tenant has failed to pay the rent, and that proper demand or notice was given to the tenant, and they still haven't paid the rent. Now, even if the landlord gives the proper notice, and even if the landlord files the petition, and even if there's a judgment at the end of the proceeding, and the judge says, I find that, you know, you're going to be evicted, you can still pay the rent at that point, and then you don't have to leave. So you have a lot of time to try to come up with the money. If it's a non-payment proceeding, if it's holdover proceeding, it's a different issue. If in the petition, and this is probably a little too much detail, but in the petition, if the landlord says that I served the notice, he has to attach the notice to the petition with a affidavit saying how the tenant was served. Okay. Then in the petition, the landlord also has to say whether he's asking for just the rent to be paid, or whether he's asking for possession of the premises, or both. If he's asking for rent, he has to state how much rent he's asking for, how much was unpaid, the period that it covers. Okay, it doesn't have to be the exact amount, but it's got to be pretty close. It's got to be a good faith estimate, and you know, if it's a monthly amount, it should be pretty easy to calculate. Then you have a first appearance, and you go to court. If you don't show up, the landlord can get what's called a default judgment against you, and then take that judgment, bring it to the sheriff with a warrant, and have you evicted, and you'll get a money judgment against you for the amount that was in the petition. If you show up for court, they'll have sometimes they call it an arraignment, where you say, I got the petition, and I deny that I owe the money, or I, you know, deny I'm doing anything wrong. And then the judge will schedule a trial. Okay? And then at the trial, the landlord has the burden to prove, A, there's a landlord-tenant relationship, what the amount of the rent was, that the tenant failed to pay it, that the proper notices were given. And then the judge will make a decision. Like I said before, if the landlord's only asking for a money judgment, then the judge isn't going to issue a warrant for eviction. And if they're only asking for eviction and no money, then they won't get a money judgment. If the tenant gets a judgment against them and they still fail to pay the rent, then it takes some time for the landlord to submit a judgment for the judge's signature. Once the judge signs it, it can be taken to the sheriff for service to evict the tenant. If the let me back up. If the tenant still hasn't paid the money, then the sheriff has to serve what's called a 72-hour notice on the tenant. Okay, and after that 72 hours is up, if the tenant is still not out of the premises, then the sheriff at any time after that can go and remove them. Technically, the sheriff doesn't actually remove anybody. They just stand there and watch you get your stuff out, but you're told to do it, and they just make sure it's done peaceably. I don't know so much about Greene County, but in Columbia County, they only do one eviction a day, and so if they have 10 people ahead of you, it's going to be 10 business days before they get to you, so that gives the tenant quite a few more days. And in fact, if you go through the back channels, if you need a couple extra days, you can kind of get them to hold back on it for you, but it's not a guarantee. So you can always find a way to buy yourself a little more time, but ultimately you don't get to stay rent free. So you got to move as quickly as you can to find another place to live. I can talk a little bit about a holdover proceeding, but I don't know if anybody here would be interested, because most evictions are going to be non-payment. Of course, if you don't pay the rent and you leave on your own before the judge issues a judgment for possession, then that would terminate the proceeding. So that's, you can either pay the rent or get out. I don't know, did anybody have any interest in a holdover proceeding?
Yes.
You do? Okay. With a holdover proceeding, you don't have the rent issue, so you can't just pay the rent and get to stay, okay? Anytime that you stay past the end of the lease, you're responsible for the reasonable value of the use and occupancy of the premises, okay? And the landlord has the burden to prove what that value is. Now, most judges are just going to accept whatever you were paying in rent is going to be the reasonable use and value. So the landlord, the judge is probably just going to, you know, take the rent and calculate how much over you stayed. that's the major difference. So you can't just pay the rent and get to stay with a holdover. This isn't really about evictions, but well, it is. But landlords can't use self-help; like they can't just change the locks and so you can't get in. There's severe penalties for that. One thing I'll say is there. Evictions are statutory, and there's the major statute in New York that covers evictions is the Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law. But there's also things in the civil practice law and rules and the general obligations law and the real property law. But if you get into like public housing and subsidized housing and rent-controlled housing, there's a lot of, you know, there's federal laws that come into play and additional state laws. But for the most part, I'm guessing that's not going to apply here. And I really don't get into that myself, so I probably couldn't answer it even if you asked the question. So I think I'm gonna leave it at that, and then if people have questions, I'll address them at the Q&A.
Thank you, Doug. David Lewis is going to talk about the mediation aspect of rental issues and communication.
Dawn, I'm going to make an executive decision here.
Yes.
That's a lot we've heard. I'm going to call for a 15-second stretch break.
Oh, okay.
I think we should all stand and stretch.
Can we get potato chips?
No potato chips. No food, just stretch.
Thank you.
This is part of what we get to do as mediators. We get to sort of control the room for a minute.
15 minutes?
All right, 15 seconds is up, gang.
See, they thought 15 minutes.
You may lose some people. I'm sorry, I just thought it might have been a good idea. Alright, as Dawn said, my name is David Lewis, and I am a volunteer mediator. And a lot of the work that I do in mediation does involve landlord, tenant, and neighborhood issues. I want to talk a little bit about what mediation is. A lot of people refer to mediation as alternative dispute resolution. Well, the word alternative really means it's instead of something else. And in a lot of cases, what it means is we use mediation instead of going to court, instead of having a judge decide an issue, whether it's between a landlord and a tenant, or whether it's between neighbors. We use the word dispute because usually something's up between people. They're either not seeing eye to eye, somebody thinks somebody else owes money, somebody didn't keep a promise. Something's up between two or more people, so there's a dispute involved. Resolution means that we as mediators, what we're trying to do, if we're successful, is bring the people that we're mediating with together to reach a resolution to what it is that brought them before us to begin with. In simple terms, what we do in mediation is we offer people an opportunity to have a conversation. I have been involved with many, many people who say to me afterwards, this is the first time we've been able to talk about this issue. If only we had had an opportunity to talk about this 6 months ago, we wouldn't even be here. So for me, the magic of mediation is it's a space where people can get together, and what we try to do as mediators is help those folks to have a conversation with each other. For us, it's not a matter of a landlord who's owed a lot of money, or a tenant who's not paying, or a neighbor who is being disrespectful to another neighbor who feels that they're being disrespected. For us, mediation is a process where everybody is treated equally. We are not in the courts at this point in time, or if we are, we're in a room other than the court. There is no one person who has any more power than the other person. Mediation is an opportunity for two people to basically be on an equal level so that they can have a conversation with each other. The other factor of mediation that is incredibly important is that a lot of people have this impression that I'll be in a room mediating between two people and they think I'm going to make a decision, I'm going to basically make a suggestion, I'm going to make a recommendation for how they solve their problem. It's just the opposite. The whole idea of mediation is what I like to call self-determination. The folks who I mediate with have the opportunity themselves to come up with the solutions. One of the things that I enjoy the most about mediation is it does not require me to be an expert in anything. It doesn't require me to make any decisions. And most importantly, it leaves me out of the process of judging what's going on with people, their lives, or their disputes. This is about the people who are involved in the dispute coming up with their own solutions to the problem. That, to me, is another part of the magic of mediation. And how do we do this? We do this because, as mediators, our role is entirely to be neutral. People come to mediation a lot of times because they've been in the courts, and they feel like the mediator is just an extension of the judge. And that's not what goes on in mediation. As I said before, our role really is to be on both sides with both people, or if there are more than two people who are involved in the dispute, to be with everyone and to be with everyone equally. Again, we are not judges. We don't make decisions. We don't cop attitudes. We don't do anything like that. We are there as mediators to be with you, to help you have that conversation. Another important factor of mediation is it is a voluntary process. Now, I have been involved oftentimes in court settings where a judge will say to two people, there may be a landlord and a tenant, you know, maybe you can work this out with the help of the mediator. So we go in and into another room and we start to have a conversation, and people are thinking, oh man, the judge made me do this. I'm not going to be able to leave. I feel like I'm going to be disadvantaged here. In mediation, once you've fulfilled the judge's obligation to start the process of having a conversation, what we as mediators will tell you is that it's voluntary from there on out. If mediation is not right for you as the participant, then you have the right to say it's not going to work. The matter either goes back to the court or back to the neighborhood, wherever it started. Finally, mediation is a confidential process. If I am mediating between two people, whatever they say to me in that private space, by the rules of ethics that we as mediators follow, we must keep it all confidential. We don't go to court later on and get called by a witness, by one or the other, saying, hey, he could tell you what she said. It doesn't work that way for us. That's really not what happens. So the cornerstones of the mediation process is the neutrality of the mediator, the voluntary nature of what happens with people, and the confidentiality of the process. And most importantly, the process itself, which is, in its simplest form, a conversation between two or more people. Now, we're here tonight talking about situations that might arise in rental situations. So where does mediation fit into that? Oftentimes, we will have situations where a landlord feels that they are not being paid rent from a tenant, and it may go into court, and again, the judge may say, you know what, maybe there's an maybe there's an opportunity for the two of you to talk about this. My role as a mediator is to help a landlord and a tenant sit down, feeling as equals, to come up and see if they can come up with a plan or a solution. Now, another issue that often comes up in the case of landlords and tenants is a tenant might come in and say, you know what, I'm not paying rent because this property is just awful. There's rats, the stove doesn't work, you know, any one of a number of different issues that the tenant feels is means that the space is not adequate for their needs. And again, if that's what's at play, then that needs to be a part of the conversation that we're all going to have to see what we want to do about it. Now, Frank, who was speaking from the landlord's perspective earlier, talked about some of the things that can happen in rental property. And sometimes it's not about rent, it's not about the conditions, but it's about people not getting along with each other. Maybe two tenants in the same building just have it out for each other for this reason or that. These are what we call neighborhood issues. It just doesn't have to even be people living in the same home. It could be people living next door on the same block. Issues going on, and all of a sudden the landlord's all upset, thinking the only way the landlord's going to have peace in this situation is to get one or more of the tenants out of there so that they can start all over. Once again, what we're talking about here is people not getting along. And oftentimes, all that's really needed is an opportunity for those folks to sit down and have a conversation. And that's where we, as mediators, come into the picture. We're there to provide space and an opportunity for them both to be heard. Because lo and behold, oftentimes, after the conversation begins, there's a common understanding that everybody reaches, and everybody sort of comes up with their own solutions. You know, maybe about the noise issue. It's, you know what, I'll cut it off at 9 o'clock, you know, instead of 10 o'clock, or all these kinds of things. And I'm not doing this as the mediator. It's the people who are involved in the mediation, the people who are not getting along with each other, the people who are not paying or who are not being paid, coming up with their own solutions. What is the timing of mediation? I talked earlier about the situation where two people come in and they start to have a conversation and they say, you know what, if only we had talked about this 6 months ago, we wouldn't even be in here in court today. You know, this all got blown out of proportion. What I would say to you is that there is a dispute resolution center in every county in New York State. Common Ground happens to be the center that I volunteer for here in Greene, and they also serve in Columbia County. Their doors are always open. There are volunteers like me who are always ready to sit down with people who are involved in a misunderstanding or a dispute. And I'd be the first to say to anyone, why wait to go to court? Deal with it now. Deal with it with an opportunity to have a neutral third party in the room with you, helping two of you or more to have a conversation to see if you can come up with a solution to what's going on that's creating all this strife and all this stress and all this crisis in your lives. There is nothing I can think of that is more scary than the thought of somebody who's about to be put out of space where they're living, where the alternative may be that they have no place to live. And for there to be an opportunity to have a conversation, to come up with a plan to work around that with a neutral third party, seems to me a much better alternative than letting a judge decide people's fate. So the opportunity is always there. Now, having said that, it's also clear that a lot of times that six-month period goes on and people don't have that conversation. Maybe something physical goes on. Maybe the landlord finally decides, you know, I've had it, and I've really got to get my space back so I can rent it to someone else. And so the matter does go to court, and everybody does show up, and perhaps the judge says, because we do have some enlightened judges in this county and others who say, maybe you can work it out. Judges do not always have the time to try and be mediators themselves, and frankly, in my view, they can't be mediators because ultimately they have decision-making authority. I consider myself a mediator because I'm not going to make any decisions. In the end, if you all can't agree about what brought you there to court, well, then the judge will decide it. But I'm going to try to help you as best as possible to have a conversation to see if you can work it out. So what happens when we have mediation? What are some of the things that can happen when we've had that conversation? Well, maybe we do come up with a plan. Maybe the landlord and the tenant sit down, they have a conversation, and the tenant says something like, you know what, it's January, and I'm getting my tax refund check the first week in March. And the landlord says, you know what, if you're willing to say that you're going to give me all the back rent when that check comes, you know, I'm good for it. Because what we heard the landlord say before is he may be out $2,000 if he doesn't, you know, get that rent taken care of. He's got to go clean that space, and he's got to go find someone else to live there, and it may be sitting on the market. Landlords have a real incentive to try and work things out. Tenants have a real incentive to try and work things out because they really don't want to have to move and try to find somewhere else. So there's opportunity, and where there's opportunity, we try to have that conversation, and maybe it comes down to a payment plan that works into the future. Maybe somebody ran on some bad luck and said, you know what, I'm starting a job next week, in another month, you know, I'll be able to, you know, start, and I'll pay you back a little bit each month, you know, until we're even. All those opportunities exist. I, as the mediator, am not going to tell you what those chances are, what those opportunities are. You all, as the people who are involved in the dispute, are the ones who have to come up with it. Maybe the plan includes, you know what, you've got to do something about this stove, or, man, you know, your heater, you know, just it's chancy. Some days it works, some days it doesn't. Can't you maybe just have a contractor come in and do something about it? Maybe it's an outcome involving two neighbors who just aren't getting along. The music is too loud, or the pets are a problem, or the kids are a problem. Whatever the case may be, we sit down and we have a conversation, and all of a sudden, you know, there's some give and take and some planning, and all of a sudden, with the creativity of the people in the room who decide that, you know, now that we haven't talked in 6 months and we're finally having this conversation, maybe we could really do something about what has driven us apart over this time. Because after all, before, you know, we used to get along so well. And I've heard that a lot of times. I've written up agreements for people who've been involved in the dispute, and as I'm writing up the agreement, they're asking about each other's families because they've lost touch and all like that. And sometimes we actually can rebuild friendships. Maybe it has to do, and Frank said this before, maybe it has to do with communication. You know, maybe it's a matter of, you know, I really don't like the fact that you bang on my door, you know, at you know, 11 o'clock in the morning because I worked the third shift and I just got to bed at 9 in the morning. You know, maybe if you could come collect the rent at a more convenient time of the day, or, you know, things like that. Or don't call me on my cell phone when I'm at work, I'm going to get fired. Sometimes it has all to do with what are the things we can do about how we're going to communicate with each other. And most importantly, even if in mediation we don't succeed in getting the two of you to come up with a solution to the problems, what I do feel we've done always is to open up the lines of communication, because I have never been involved in a situation in the years that I've been a mediator where I felt that having the conversation, even if it went nowhere, sent us backwards from where we were before we had that talk. So that's what mediation is all about for me, and that's, I think, what mediation can bring to matters involving neighborhoods, landlords, tenants, and the like.
Thank you, David. David is very passionate. He's a wonderful volunteer, and I was remiss in not mentioning that everyone here, all of our panelists, have generously and graciously volunteered their time this evening to talk with you. So I'm very appreciative of that. Next, I would like to introduce Lawrence, who would talk to you about opportunities that are available to you through her agency, Community Action. Thank you.
Community Action is a private nonprofit. Quite often we're mistaken. mistaken as a part of county government, which we are not. We're overseen by a group of volunteers, a board of directors from all parts of Greene County, from the mountaintop out to Pixahkee, all over the county. And what that does is everyone brings an area of expertise. They look in their own communities and see what's lacking, what's holding people back from being successful and being self-sufficient. Quite often, one part of your life can experience some kind of difficulty or crisis, and you just start spiraling everything. It affects everything in your life. You know, what we do is we look at ways we can help you become more self-sufficient or help people in the community become more self-sufficient. Right now, we have two main divisions in our agency. We have our weatherization assistance program. It's primarily a program for homeowners, but it actually can help renters as well. If a landlord agrees to sign into an agreement with our weatherization program and a percentage of the renters in the building meet income guidelines, we can go in and we can do diagnostic measures. We've sent an auditor in, and he can look and see where energy is being lost in the apartment and come up with a work plan to make that more energy efficient so your utility bills are a lot less. They can add insulation into a building. They can add air caulking and air sealing. Look at that. They can look at furnaces and see if they need replacement or to be tuned. Sometimes they can replace windows. And this is at no cost to the renter or the homeowner. There may be a contribution from the landlord, but it's usually no more than 50%. There's also a program we have called Empower New York. And what that does is just look strictly at electrical usage. And they can come into an apartment or a home and look at your refrigerators, your freezers, your air conditioning, your hot water heaters. And if they're old and using up a lot of electricity, they can be replaced with newer, more energy efficient models. The other division of our agency, we recently combined two departments, is Family, Community, and Victim Services. Under that is our domestic violence program. Frank did mention domestic disputes is something that landlords, you know, can affect a tenant-landlord relationship. And as advocates, we're here to say that, you know, nobody has to live in a household where there are domestic disputes or there's violence. There's assistance out there for you. We have residential programs. We have shelters in both Greene and Columbia counties. Or we have support counseling in both counties. We can do assistance with orders of protection. We have an aftercare coordinator. We have a community educator that can come out into the schools and the civic groups and talk about the programs that we have and the dynamics of domestic violence. And then we have family and community development, which is kind of a catch-all for everything that doesn't fall under the other two categories. And a lot of that really deals with self-sufficiency. We have programs that we understand in Greene County there are a lack of resources. There's a lack of employment opportunities. And we do programming around that. We have a resource room that was originally started with a grant from the Workforce Investment Act years ago. But in our office, we have a computer that is open to anybody in need. You can come in and look at the computer. A lot of the big box stores now, you have to do your applications online for the Walmarts and the Home Depot. You can do apartment searches online. Our receptionist every day prints off job postings. She prints off apartment listings. There's a telephone there. If you need a fax, if you need a copy of something or help with a resume, we can do that. Transportation is a major issue to anybody, whether it's for employment or for any other reason. We have two programs that deal with transportation right now. We have our partners Catch a Ride, and if you need a ride to work or a job-related training, you can call our office. We're limited. Greene County is pretty big, and right now we have one driver, but we accommodate as many people as we can and try to bring people to the, you know, to employment. We also have a Wheels for Work auto loan program. If somebody has a steady work history for a minimum of 3 months, you can have no credit history, you can have poor credit history, and we will still work with you if you have the ability to repay a loan. We work with the Bank of Greene County, and we do low-interest car loans for up to $5,000 if you have the ability to pay it back. A part of what we do with that program, too, is looking at your budget. We realize it's difficult out there. We'll give you advice on when we look at your budget. If you don't have the ability to repay, maybe we can help you. But what we do is we sit down with you and teach you how to look at your credit report. A lot of people don't know how to do that. Our resource specialist will sit down and review that with you, give you some guidelines on how to clean up your credit and start to improve your credit. If you can't qualify for the loan at the original time, we may send you back, pend the loan, and have you come back in a few months later after you've shown some ability to clean up your credit. We have, Maria mentioned stimulus monies for rental assistance. HPRP, Homelessness Prevention and Rapid Rehousing, that money unfortunately is set to expire in June, but what we've been able to do for the past year or so is to help people pay their rent. A lot of people have experienced unemployment, long-term unemployment recently, or they have illness, or they've experienced something that set them back in their rent. We can, if you meet income guidelines and certain qualifications set by the government, we can come in and give you some assistance paying rent or rental arrears, security, and utilities. We're very hopeful that at the end of June, that money will turn into another grant. Unfortunately, right now, we don't know that for certain. We have a program where we're able to take donated furniture in and we store it, and people moving from either temporary shelter or our domestic violence shelters, if you need furniture, we take in good used beds, dressers, tables, that sort of thing, and help people set up their new apartments. I have to backtrack. Along with the HPRP, we do have one grant right now through HUD where we can help support housing, permanent housing, for two chronically homeless individuals. We've just been granted funding for another two beds for victims of domestic violence, and we're in the process of writing a third grant through HUD where we will be able to help families experiencing domestic violence, and that's with supportive housing. We work very closely with other agencies in the community, and we try our best to make sure that we know what other services are, what other agencies are providing. If we can't provide a service, we may refer you to Castle Mountain Housing or refer you to Tenants' Rights or Catholic Charities or other people in the community that might be able to assist you. We have a VITA program. Somebody mentioned tax returns and a light went off. We're a VITA site, which is Voluntary Income Tax Assistance. Quite often we find people with very limited incomes pay $200-$300 or more for very simple tax returns with paid preparers. We have volunteers, or three of us in the agency right now, that each year are tested out by the IRS. We'll do your income taxes for free. We can e-file. If you direct deposit your refunds into a bank account, you have your money in 5 to 7 business days. We do about 300 returns a year now. We're going into our 6th year, I believe, doing taxes. And that's an important piece of information. A lot of people either can't afford to pay the preparers, so they don't file their taxes. You might not be aware of their earned income tax credit, and that's for low-income workers. The government gives you incentives to pay your taxes and for employment, to be employed. We have an emergency food pantry. Sometimes the difference between paying the rent, putting food on the table, people are in a tough spot. We have an emergency food pantry where people can come in and get a 3-day supply of food. We also have an extra helpings food buying club, where sort of a food co-op through the regional food bank, where at a very discounted amount you can order a different menu every month. That's at our site, and we're the only site in Greene County for extra helpings where you can actually use your food stamps if you have your benefit card to pay for those extra helpings. What did I miss? Anything, ladies? Here comes Christmas, and I have it. That's a big one coming up right now. We understand that people in tough financial situations, you want the same thing for your families and your kids as everybody else does. And quite often, people make poor decisions around the holidays because you want to provide for your kids. Well, we try to help you make the right decisions. This will be the third year where we've taken over the Here Comes Christmas program for Greene County. And for the past 2 years, we provided gifts for over 800 children in the county. We operated as an adopt-a-family program. We asked people in the community, different offices, agencies, Girl Scout clubs, ski clubs, and just concerned people in the community that want to do something to make their community a better place. They adopt a family for the holidays. And that's a resource. Around September, we do the back-to-school drive. Again, it takes a lot of money anymore to send a kid off to school on the first day. I mean, if you're a parent, you've seen the list of school supplies. It's not cheap. So what we do is we help take that burden off as well. And for the past few years, we've supplied about 300 kids a year with backpacks and school supplies. And we just finished up our coat and blanket drive. We do that every year. We take really good used donations from the community and make them available to anybody in need. And again, you know, that's a list. I believe that's about everything we do. But if you ever have a question or you need some help, if we don't offer the service, we can probably direct you to somebody who can. So that's us in a nutshell. And at the end, if you have any questions, we'll be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Florence. I'm going to take a reading. We have two more people to speak. Do you want to take a 10-minute break now or break after everyone has had a chance to talk and then do question and answers? What's your feeling? What is it?
Break now.
Okay, but make sure you come back. 10 minutes, folks. Thank you.
This is Tom Rowe. You're listening to WGXC Online Radio, live from the Greene County Emergency Services Building in Cairo, where Common Ground, the Dispute Resolution Group, is holding a second chance renter rehabilitation seminar. And we're hearing from the panel. We're at about two-thirds of the way through the panel, and then we're going to have a question and answer session right afterwards. And if you're listening to WGXC, today, tune in again tomorrow night. WGXC Online Radio is going to have live coverage of the election results as they come in. We'll have staff at the Columbia County Board of Elections office, and we'll have some phone-in take calls from election campaign headquarters around the two counties and try to report on Greene and Columbia County election results, as well as state and national election results. That's tomorrow night, starting at 6 p.m. Till midnight on WGXC Online Radio. And then again on Thursday night, WGXC will be live at the Community Theater of Catskill on Main Street in Catskill for an Amy Goodman appearance. And you're listening to WGXC Online Radio. There's a small break in the program tonight. We're live from the Greene County Emergency Services Building in Cairo, a 25 volunteer drive. And we are coming to you with a workshop from Common Ground, the dispute resolution nonprofit. And that workshop is called Second Chance Renter Rehabilitation Seminar and is a has a panel of seven different experts on tenants' rights and landlord rights and landlord responsibilities and tenant responsibilities. And we're currently in the midst of a workshop from our panel most of which have given their presentations. There's a couple left, and then there's going to be a question and answer session from the assembled audience. So you're listening to WGXC Online Radio, live from the Greene County Emergency Services Center in Cairo, and we'll be coming at you for about another hour or so with this. Listening to WGXC Online Radio, live from the Greene County Emergency Services Building in Cairo. What else is coming up on WGXC? It looks like hopefully we're getting on the air in sometime in December, if all things go well. We'll be on 90.7 FM. And events of this type will be live on the FM radio and on the internet. You'll have your choice to get them either way. Again, you're listening to WGXC Online Radio. Our panel tonight is, we have heard already from Maria Markovitz, from the Executive Director of the United Tenants of Albany. We've heard from Frank Cuthbert, a Catskill landlord. We've heard from Doug Coleman, a local attorney. We've heard from David Lewis, a mediator from Common Ground, and we've heard from Florence Oley, the Executive Director of Community Action of Greene County, and we're still waiting for Lawrence Krajewski, and from the Executive Director of Catskill Mountain Housing, and William Fisher, Fair Housing Officer for Columbia County Housing Resources. And after their two presentations, which are the two presentations that are left, we're going to have a short question and answer period from the audience with questions for about landlords, tenants, tenants' rights, landlords' rights, tenant responsibilities, landlord responsibilities, all those sort of things that you've been hearing so far in this great seminar coming to you live from the Greene County Emergency Services Building in Cairo. You're listening to WGXC Online Radio. And tune in again tomorrow night, as I said before, for election coverage from the WGXC Hudson studio. We'll have folks at the Columbia County Board of Elections office. We'll be getting elections from Greene County as they come in on the website, and we'll be following election races from around the state and the country, and we'll be interviewing local politicians, local running for office. We'll have some reports from local campaign headquarters and more. We're trying to get some candidates to get them on the phone tomorrow night and ask some questions as the results come in and we see what the new look of Greene County. I mean, there are not too many local races in Columbia County. There's a coroner race and a the other treasurer or judge. And in Greene County, there's a judge race between Charles Taylor and David Wooden. And Greene County Treasurer's race between Alan Pavese and Peter Marcoux are the two big races. There's also a town board position in Greenville that's up for contention tomorrow night. And, of course, the state races for governor, attorney general, and the like, and the national races for the congressional seats and the Senate seats in New York, most notably the race between Chris Gibson and Representative Scott Murphy for the New York 20th Congressional District. Gibson trying to unseat the Democrat Scott Murphy, and polls recently showing that he's got the lead, so we'll see if he does indeed, if the Kinderhook Republican Chris Gibson does indeed unseat Scott Murphy tomorrow night. But tune in all day on election day for more details, and if you go to the WGXC Newsroom website right now, you can watch video today of President Bill Clinton in Saratoga Springs for Scott Murphy with Kirsten Gillibrand. A rally this morning there. There's video from the Capitol Confidential website. That's the Albany Times Union's political website. you're listening to WGXC Online Radio live from the Greene County Emergency Services Building in Cairo. We're standing by for a few more minutes before the workshop to resume. The workshop is the Second Chance Rental Rehabilitation Seminar, brought to you by Common Ground, the dispute resolution nonprofit group that's mission is to provide the citizens of Columbia and Greene counties with an efficient and self-directed process for resolution of personal, civil, and criminal disputes experienced as part of everyday living. Yes. Excuse me. You're listening to WGXC Online Radio live from Cairo tonight. With this workshop just about to return. What other news can I get you at the moment while we wait? And sounds like WGXC Online Radio, coming to you live from the Greene County Emergency Services Building in Cairo, where this workshop has been held, and Second Chance Renter Rehabilitation Seminar is just about to restart again in a second, as everyone makes their way to their seats. You're listening to WGXC Online Radio, coming to 90.7 FM next month in December, right now online at WGXC.org. The panelists are taking their seats, and we're going to add a little more sound and a little less me as we get closer to Okay. Panels just back to get started in a second, and you're listening to WGXC Online Radio.
Service and delivery agency, and we work here in Greene County. Much like Florence's group, we're a nonprofit organization, and we do a lot of work through government contracts, etc. We provide assistance to first-time home buyers to help them buy. We do home repairs for people who own their own homes in Greene County. We do a little bit of counseling. We have a grant to help pre-foreclosure counseling, and we do try to do some general counseling as well in our office. It's not any great shakes there, but we do try to help people who run into housing problems, and we also own and manage our own properties in Greene County. Don had asked me to talk a little bit about credit and credit reports. As Frank had mentioned in his presentation, a responsible professional landlord will generally ask for a credit report. And while we don't always deal with responsible and professional landlords, for the most part, if they're on the ball, they're going to be looking for that from a tenant. So it is important to build a decent credit report. It's also important for when you want to make that next step, if the opportunity comes to you to buy a home. I would tell my classes, my first-time homebuyer classes, that there was a time when you could tell, I could tell a class that virtually anyone could get a mortgage if they were willing to pay for it. Those times have come and gone, I hope. And I think the banks are going to be a lot tougher, and so building a good credit report over time will be very important for someone who wants to take that step. But it's important too for the tenant who wants to make a good presentation, and have a wide choice of rentals. It's important to take a look at your credit. Credit in this country is monitored by three private agencies, Experian, TransUnion, and Equifax. And by federal regulation, they're obligated to provide each consumer with a free credit report upon their request each year. So you could actually ask for a free credit report from one agency in January. You could ask for another credit report from an agency in March or April. And you could ask for a third one in September, and then start the rotation again next year and basically have a pretty good monitoring system. Whether you want to put up with all the aggravation of asking for it every 3 months is up to you. But there is a website that is run by all three of the agencies. All three of the agencies obviously sell a lot of credit services to consumers. Their main business is providing credit reports to businesses and banks, but they also provide all these services you hear about on TV. Where, you know, for $35 a year, you sign up for all sorts of credit reporting and credit information. And they're kind of practice a little bit of deception in calling their services free credit report or free credit analysis.com, whatever. But the website you want to go to is called, I want to make sure I get this straight, annualcreditreport.com. And that's the website you can get into and request a free credit report from one of the three agencies. And you really should try to get a copy of it. If you haven't looked at it in years or you've never looked at it, it's a good idea to have a look at it every now and then, just to see how you're doing, where you stand. A credit report is going to show a variety of things. Most importantly, it's going to show who you owe money to. And that's basically divided into two groups, people who have extended revolving credit to you, like a credit card company, and installment credit, which is credit that you use to buy a car or to have a student loan. So they're going to show who you owe money to, how much credit has been extended to you, what the credit limit is on the credit card, or how much money they lent you when you first bought your car. They're going to show how much you owe now on that revolving credit or that installment credit. And the most important part is they're going to show how often you've been late with your payments. Now, being late with your payments in the credit card report is really is looking at how often you've been late 30 days or more. So they're going to track how often you've been either 30 days or 60 days or 90 days late in making your payments. A couple of the other things that will also be on your credit report, they're going to show any bankruptcies you might have been involved in, foreclosures, repossessions, and any judgments that are listed against you. Another common thing that we see for people is things like medical payments. We see a lot of folks come in to us with credit reports that show past due medical payments. So if you go into the emergency room and you can't afford to pay the $500 to fix your broken arm, the hospital will eventually turn it over to a collection agency, and the collection agency will list that on your credit report. So that's something else that does show up. I know a lot of lenders, and I think even probably some landlords kind of discount that a little bit because it's the sort of thing that can happen to someone, at least up until the time we had health insurance reform. There's a lot of people that don't have health insurance, and it's kind of difficult. But that's the kind of thing that we see a lot of if people have. And the other thing that will show up similar to medical collections are utility collections. If you haven't paid your Central Hudson bill or your Mid-Hudson cable bill, they will also put you on the credit report. They generally don't track you, but if you make your payments regularly, they won't show up on your credit report. But when you don't pay them and they go after you in collection, then that will show up on your credit report. The last thing that the credit report will do is they'll list people who have requested your credit in recent days. So when you go to the mall and they say, if you fill out this form for a Walmart credit card, we'll give you a free 2-liter bottle of soda. When you fill out that form and you sign your name, you've given them permission to look at your credit report, and in turn, it will show up on your credit report that Walmart has requested it. And all those things come together. I'm sure you've all heard of credit scores. All of the credit agencies have a mathematical formula where they take all the information on your credit report and mix it all into this big mathematical algorithm and come out with a credit score which shows how good or bad you are on your credit. Those credit scores, by the way, aren't available on the free credit report. They're only obligated to give you your credit report itself. But if you go a little deeper, you will see a credit score. Your landlord might reference this credit score as well. But it's mostly important to take a look at what's there and review. Number one, you want to check to see, you know, that the information is accurate. There is sometimes when the credit agencies will simply get it wrong. They'll report somebody else's bad credit on your credit report. So you want to look at it carefully and determine that in fact the entries are accurate. One other important thing about credit, especially for people who are low income, is that you actually show up with no credit history. I know a lot of people come in thinking that they'll have good credit report, a good credit history because they have never borrowed money, and therefore they've never been late with any payments. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. The credit lenders are all looking to see what your history is, and if they don't see a positive history, if they don't see any history, then they think it's bad, and they're going to likely reject you. And a landlord, I don't know, I guess a landlord probably would feel a little more comfortable with seeing a report with no history rather than one with a bad history. But for the most part, you know, it is important if you're looking long term at borrowing money to be able to build a good credit report. I am going to pass around some information that has some tips on how to build a better credit report. I've listed the names and phone numbers of the agencies. Sure. So some of the things you can do to help correct your credit or to improve your credit, first and importantly, is to check your credit report to make sure the information is accurate, to have a good handle on what your credit situation is. You want to try to establish positive credit. Like I said, a positive history is important. It adds to the strength of your report and the strength of your score. A lot of folks, some folks think that getting rid of some credit cards is a good idea. You know, if you have too many credit cards, if you're not using a credit card, then it might be better to close the account. But if that account represents positive history, if it's a credit card you've always paid on time and you've always been diligent about keeping up, that's a good positive history. You want to keep it on your report. The credit you want to close is the one you've been 30 days or 60 days late with that might not have a positive credit. We can get you some extra ones. I have plenty up here. Okay. Another thing to look at is to try to negotiate with some of the bad accounts. If you are in a situation where you haven't been able to pay on a credit item for some time, it's worthwhile if you have some money that you can negotiate with to talk to the creditor. For example, let's say you owe $1,000 to Citibank, and you see that it's gone into a collection agency, and recently you came into $400 that you figure you're going to take and use to try to work on some of your credit and get it down. One of the things you might do is to to pick up the phone next time Citibank called, or even to call them and say, look, I have $400. I'm willing to give you that $400 to pay off this credit, but I want it to be paid in full. I want to get rid of this. I don't want to see it on my credit report anymore. So if it's in collection agency, that's an indication that it's already discounted, because when Citibank sold it to the collection agency, they probably sold it for 50 cents on the dollar or less. So a $400 offer might be attractive to that collection agency. The important thing here is that you want to make sure that the collection agency agrees in full to eliminate that piece of credit. And in the handout I gave you, there's a nice letter. It's kind of written in an old-style font, but it's listed as creditor settlement on account number. And it's the kind of letter you'd want to write to the creditor before you made the payment. So you had an agreement with them that they would take off the negative credit in return for a payment on the bill. Because that's important. You want to make sure that they're going to take that piece of bad credit off. Last, but I think most importantly, is to really just take a look at budgeting your household expenses so that you can pay your bills on time. A lot of people, they just live from paycheck to paycheck. They don't really think about what they need to pay. Take the time to sit down and write your expenses out and figure out what you're obligated to pay each month. Think of everything that you have, you know, all of the little expenses, and don't forget to put in the $20 you need to just have in your pocket, the money you need to pay for gas. But put it all into a budget and try to stick to it. That's important. I don't have anything fancy to give you, to hand out to you on that, but I think it's just simple. You know, sit down, think about your expenses, think about what your income is, and figure out how you pay your bills each month. And try to keep good track of it. Because just doing that and paying your bills on time will, over time, help correct your credit. The other thing I wanted to talk about just briefly was resources. One of the things that Catskill Mountain Housing does is we are a landlord, too. You know, we engage in the second oldest profession. I guess the oldest profession in America is being Charlie Sheen's dating service. I had to do a pop reference. But, we do manage housing in Greene County. It's mostly for seniors, but a couple of our properties are open to persons with disabilities, so people can make an application there. I have brought a list of apartment properties that we know of, other apartment properties other than Catskill Mountain Housing. I'll just hand out this list. Sure. Just briefly, I know that on the right side, Rivertown Senior Apartments also accepts persons with disabilities, but they're all one-bedroom apartments. I think on the left-hand side, Bethany Village is seniors, but all the rest of the apartments that are listed have one, two, and three-bedroom apartments. With subsidized housing, everybody maintains and manages their own waiting lists. So making an application to Catskill Mountain Housing won't help you get an apartment anywhere else but with us. So it's important that you, if you qualify for subsidized housing, that you put your name on as many lists as you can. The waiting lists for senior and disabled housing generally runs a year to a year and a half. For family housing, like the Catskill Housing Authority's facility and some of the other facilities, runs even longer, 2 or 3 years. But it is worthwhile, if you're in that income category and you think you're going to stay in that income category, to think about putting your name in some sometime you might get to that point where you could be accepted as a tenant. The second major resource for tenants is the Section 8 program. That's run by Green County. It's run out of the Carroll office building here down the street from here. And that program, I know, takes about 2 or 3 years for a waiting list. But that is a subsidy that is assigned to a family or a person, which gives them the right to go out and negotiate a tenancy with a private landlord. And under those circumstances, as with the subsidized housing properties, the tenant pays 30% of their monthly income for rent, and then the rest is made up through a subsidy that is either paid to the building owner or to the landlord, to the private landlord. But those are programs that are designed to assist low-income tenants to help them manage and maintain a long-term tenancy. With that, thank you.
Thank you very much, Larry. Next, I would like to introduce Bill Fisher, who is from Columbia County Housing.
Yes, I'm the Fair Housing Officer for Columbia County, and I am assisted by a 15-member advisory board that is very diverse in nature. A lot of what I've heard here tonight reminds me of the members that serve on our board. We have someone from Columbia Opportunities, we have someone from Housing Resources, we have clergy, financial people, and our job primarily is to assure that discrimination does not take place in either the purchase or the rental of housing. We're often confused with the word fair housing. We get a lot of calls about, from people who feel that maybe they've been treated unfairly, maybe a landlord isn't living up to his or her end of the lease arrangement, maybe there's a problem, and I think that was mentioned here tonight, with the warranty of habitability. Particularly as it comes to paying rent, people who feel that they're not getting the services that they should be getting, like heat, hot water, safe living conditions, will often feel that they're being treated unfairly. So we do get a lot of those kind of calls, and when we do, we usually try to point them in the right direction. I've sent some on to United Tenants, to the Attorney General's office, those types of things. We do send out a lot of tenants' rights handbooks to tenants, maybe just outlining certain areas that might apply to whatever complaint they might have. But usually we tell them if it comes down to any kind of legal dispute that they should contact an attorney. But fair housing actually deals with civil rights, not to be confused with just being treated unfairly. Dawn mentioned that I was to talk about civil rights maybe no longer than 15 minutes today. So I said, now how am I going to do that? Because I can just name off the protected classes of people who are actually come under the civil rights laws and so forth, and tell them how to file a complaint, and that would pretty much be it. But the civil rights laws have really taken about 150 years to become what they are today. So I thought I'd take about 100 years to tell you about it tonight. So can everyone see the flip chart? Should we move it? Okay, the history of fair housing, a long time coming. Actually, it goes back to the original Civil Rights Bill of, the Emancipation Proclamation in January 1st, 1863. That recognized slavery as a form of discrimination And that's what we're talking about here primarily is discrimination. At that time, the African Americans that lived in the country were only considered to be 3/5 of a person. So they really weren't getting any rights to speak of. So we start with the Emancipation Proclamation. And then there was the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which prohibits discrimination based on race or color. So that was kind of the beginning of the protected classes. And without exception, all citizens of the U.S. shall have the right to enjoy, the same rights in property conveyances, ownership, and so forth, that the whites were enjoying at that time. Of course, we all know that this was only the beginning because there are a number of more protected classes as we go along, and it's taken really basically about 150 years for all this to happen. See, you can see, we went all the way from 1866 to April 11th of 1968. So we have 102 years there that really nothing happened to the civil rights law. And at that point, Lyndon B. Johnson signed into law the Fair Housing Act. And that was actually 1 week after the assassination of Martin Luther King. In addition to race and color, remember in 1866 it was just race and color, they added religion and national origin. So now we're up to four classes here. The Housing and Community Development Act of 1974 extended the protection to cover gender. At one time, women couldn't get a loan or even sign a lease without having their husband's signature on it. Because particularly the women are a protected class now. The Fair Housing Amendments of 1988 added people with handicaps, disabilities, and people with children. You'll see something called familial status, which means children under 18 years old. So any kind of advertising that says no children allowed, specifically geared to keeping children out, that would be prohibited. And then comes along the Americans with Disability Act of 1992, and that prohibited discrimination based on disability, but it also said that a landlord, particularly in multifamily dwellings, would have to make accommodations for anyone with a disability, but that would be made at the tenant's expense. So the landlord wouldn't be expected to pay for it, and if the tenant moves out, they would be obliged to put the apartment back into the shape that it was before they rented it. Fair housing is the law and says we cannot discriminate based on race, color, religion, gender, handicap, familial status, and that again means children under 18, and national origin. In summary, the disparate treatment theory of housing discrimination is easily recognized since it involves discrimination toward those protected by the law. And those protected by the law, we said, were these classes up above. An aggrieved person must establish that they are a member of the protected class. could afford the property and that the housing opportunity remained after rejection. What that basically means is that they would have to be one of these protected classes to file a complaint, and they would have to demonstrate they could afford the rental property or the property that they were going to purchase. Naturally, if they're turned down because they're not financially able to afford payments and so forth, or afford the property, they can't consider that to be discrimination. But oftentimes, someone will call, and that's where this opportunity remained after rejection. Oftentimes, somebody will call and say, I'd like to see your apartment, and because of certain reasons, perhaps a landlord doesn't particularly want to have a certain person in there, says, oh, that property's already rented. And so if that property remains empty, then certainly there was not a truthful statement made there. HUD enforcement. Person must file a complaint within 1 year of alleged discrimination. The complaint can be filed in person, by mail, or by phone. HUD offers free legal representation. Now, there are other ways that you can file a complaint. You can go through civil court. Department of Law and Justice gets involved, but that's usually to assist HUD in their investigation and so forth, and maybe make some legal determination. But the two main ways are through the HUD and also through Direct Court Act, okay? Now, if you get involved with the direct court action, however, you know, you might be liable for some legal fees, and court actions usually take longer than HUD. In New York State, if there is a complaint, normally HUD would refer that complaint to Division of Human Resources in New York State. So they kind of wind up with that complaint anyway, but they would follow through. And there's certain time limits in which they have to do things, and things do get bogged down in civil court. So the HUD process is usually much quicker. As far as damages are concerned, monetary damages we're talking about, the monetary damages can be pretty severe for the landlords. I mean, they can be, large sums. However, the damages to the tenant usually resolve in maybe small awards, like just the actual damages. If they have to pay rent somewhere else, or it costs them money to move their belongings and so forth. So it usually boils down to what they actually suffered in monetary damages. So that's pretty much a history of fair housing and what it means and what courses of action you can take if need be.
Okay, all right, thank you, Bill. Thank you, everybody. Okay, now I'd like to turn the floor over to you. Are there any questions that you may have for any one of the panelists? Anyone?
If you don't mind, I'd like to just break one thing that I forgot to mention. That's that our office is in Catskill at 448 Main Street, and that we we're open from 9 to 4:30 on Monday through Friday. And if you have an issue or if you have a problem, you want to come by feel free to do so. I don't know, did you mention your student address?
At the beginning, just briefly. No. Major?
Both of you, actually.
Okay.
But we're at 53 South Jefferson Heights, and we're there 8:30 to 4:30, Monday through Friday. We're closed from 12 to 1 every day for lunch.
We're at 11 Blaine Street, Catskill, and 247 Warren Street in Hudson. Does anyone have any questions? No? None?
It was a good cemetery. I learned a lot.
Thank you. I passed out a little.
I was wondering if I could be discriminated against for having a criminal history if I'm looking for an apartment.
Most applications, and I think perhaps Frank can deal with that, but most applications that I've seen do have a question on it, whether or not you've been convicted of of a crime. Have you been charged with it is one thing, usually, but were you convicted and what comes up with another thing. And I don't think, personally, I would believe that's not discrimination.
To be frank with you, and that's a standard part of our application, is to ask you permission so we can run a criminal background check. So you should be aware of that.
So is your question whether that's discrimination or whether there are, what is exactly your
view? I was just wondering if I could be,
So does the landlord have a right to say I'm not going to rent to you?
I sure hope so. I mean that, I know it's a serious issue. And I think like Frank said in the beginning, you'd probably be better off being open about that and being prepared to explain your situation. I mean, I think common people do have some compassion, and we do. I mean, we have to be wary, of course, we're managing senior housing too, so we may err on the part of caution. But folks do get into trouble from time to time, and our expectation as a society is that you're going to be able to find a way out of it and improve your lot in life.
I might just add that oftentimes you see ads in the paper, no smokers, no pets. That is not a form of discrimination.
Any other questions?
Okay.
All right, well, I hope you had an enjoyable evening. And again, thank you for coming, and very special thanks to our panelists. On the back table, there are certificates of completion. For those of you who do not pre-register, we have some blank ones that George will give you and you can just fill in your name.
Thank you. All right, you've been listening to WGXC Online Radio. This is a live seminar called Second Chance Renter Rehabilitation Seminar from the Common Ground Dispute Resolution Group, live from the Greene County Emergency Services Building in Cairo. You're listening to WGXC Online Radio.